Ukraine says it will hold further talks with the United States on agreeing a peace deal with Russia just days after a public row between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky in the White House. The announcement came hours after the US confirmed it had stopped sharing intelligence with Kyiv. The Foreign Office has strongly condemned the criminal conviction in Russia of a British man who was captured while fighting alongside Ukrainian troops. Police warn that there could be up to 50 more victims of a Chinese student who's been convicted of drugging and raping 10 women. The White House has revealed that it has held direct talks with Hamas over releasing US-Israeli hostages held in Gaza. And...
Bryson here. I'm here to tell you about Dalmier Golf Course, how important public golf course is to the community.
The US Open champion trying to save a public golf course near Glasgow from the axe. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said there's been positive movement in his engagement with the United States, and he expected to see results next week. The head of his office, Andriy Yermak, said both sides had agreed to hold further talks about ending Russia's invasion. Earlier, US officials confirmed that intelligence sharing with Ukraine had been suspended as part of moves by President Trump to force Kyiv to negotiate a peace deal. This evening, France's President Macron said his country would be willing to discuss extending its nuclear deterrent to protect its allies. He said he wanted to believe the United States would remain by Europe's side, but that it had to be prepared if that was not the case. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale.
After last week's rupture in the Oval Office, the diplomatic dust has begun to settle. President Trump told Congress he appreciated the letter he received from President Zelensky, which praised his leadership and welcomed a proposed minerals deal. In his nightly address, Mr. Zelensky said there had been positive movement, and his chief of staff said both sides had agreed to hold talks soon. The US National Security Advisor Mike Waltz said he'd had good talks with his Ukrainian counterpart about the location, delegations and substance of any discussions. And he suggested that if there were progress, the US might end the pause on military aid to Ukraine it announced earlier this week.
I think if we can nail down these negotiations and move towards these negotiations and in fact put some confidence building measures on the table, then the president will take a hard look at lifting this pause. We have to know that both sides are sincerely negotiating towards a partial then permanent peace.
But for now, that military aid remains suspended, and it was confirmed today that it includes a ban on the sharing of intelligence with Ukraine. That will have an immediate impact on the battlefield, with Ukraine finding it harder to track incoming missiles and glide bombs or attack Russian targets behind its front lines. The CIA director, John Ratcliffe, said this was making President Zelensky think again.
On the military front and the intelligence front, the pause that allowed that to happen, I think, will go away. And I think we'll work shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine, as we have, to push back on the aggression that's there, but to put the world in a better place for these peace negotiations to move forward.
So for all the conciliatory noises and reduction in tensions, the essentials remain. Donald Trump is still putting huge pressure on a supposed ally to agree a surrender ceasefire on his terms, one that cedes territory to Russia and mineral resources to the US without guarantees to ensure Ukraine's future security. In a speech to the French nation this evening, President Macron said there should be no capitulation. Peace, he said, could not be achieved at any price. And it still remains unclear what price President Putin will demand. The Kremlin today said merely it would react positively to the latest developments.
So what's been the reaction among US lawmakers to the pause in military intelligence to Ukraine? Tom Bateman's been speaking to Republican and Democrat senators, many of whom were responsible for signing off on the support for Ukraine.
In the hallways of Congress, Senator Cory Booker was taking a selfie with constituents. But the smiles were only for the camera. Democrats are fuming at President Trump's treatment of Ukraine and his suspension of military and intelligence support.
I think this is a betrayal of Congress's intent. We have been very clear, and to halt already approved military support is just functionally fundamentally, unacceptable. And we're going to do everything we can to stand with Ukraine and support them.
Last spring, Congress passed a $60 billion weapons package. Now, Democrats like Senator Tim Kaine are questioning the legality of suspending it.
It's a huge mistake. Huge. I mean, this secession of aid, military aid that Congress has appropriated, I think is illegal. And the cessation of intelligence sharing is a huge mistake.
What is this likely to mean, as far as you're aware, for Ukrainian forces on the battlefield?
It will hurt them, but just the message that's sent is also kind of doubles the hurt, because it's just further evidence of a lack of commitment.
Republicans have always been more divided on support for Ukraine. In the months after Russia's invasion, some traveled to Kyiv shoulder to shoulder with President Zelensky. Among them was Senator John Cornyn.
What I'd like to hear now is what Mr. Putin's willing to contribute to the negotiations. So far, we've just heard what is Ukraine willing to do. And I think without a credible offer by Mr. Putin, it's hard to see where this will go.
But many of Mr. Trump's Republicans, including Senator Rick Scott, see his hard line as a way of leveraging Europe to better defend itself.
I've spent time with some of our European countries. They don't want to do their part in defense. They just want us to do it. You can't expect American taxpayers and men and women to do all this. The Europeans are going to have to start standing up.
What concessions should Vladimir Putin make in order to reach this peace?
I have no idea.
That view reflects the public messaging from the White House, which has yet to set out explicit concessions that it expects of Moscow as part of any truce with Ukraine.
The Prime Minister has paid tribute to British veterans who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan after the US Vice President J.D. Vance was accused of making disrespectful remarks about UK troops during a television interview. Without directly referring to Mr. Vance's comments criticising a potential European peacekeeping force in Ukraine, Sir Keir Starmer opened Prime Minister's questions by honouring British troops who had died in combat. Our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus was watching.
Make no mistake, this was a highly unusual move by the Prime Minister, naming soldiers who died in the line of duty, not this week, but well before that.
Tomorrow marks 13 years since six young British soldiers were on patrol in Afghanistan when their vehicle was struck by an explosive, tragically killing them all. Sergeant Nigel Coop was 33. Corporal Jake Hartley was 20.
All the men, Sir Keir said, gave their lives supporting an ally. Of course, that was the US after 9/11. It was an ever so subtle rebuke of the US Vice President, who disparaged the idea of what he called troops from some random country that had not fought a war in recent years being sent to Ukraine to support a peace deal. He denied he was referring to the UK and France, but they are the only two countries that have said they are prepared to send soldiers. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, asked about the US withholding intelligence. Sir Keir said he would not choose between allies. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, pressed him on the US stopping both intelligence and military aid.
Both those decisions mean more brave Ukrainians will die and further embolden Vladimir Putin. So can the Prime Minister tell the House, does he still believe that President Trump is a reliable ally?
Look, we work very closely with the United States on defence, on security and on intelligence. We have done for many, many years. We're intertwined and, of course, they're a reliable ally.
But speaking to a House of Lords Defence Committee, four former UK ambassadors to Washington voiced concerns. Sir David Manning said the track records of some of Donald Trump's top team could make sharing sensitive intelligence a problem, and the US President's bullying of Ukraine called into question the fundamentals of our relationship.
It seems to me there's been a seismic change. I think Ukraine illustrates this very clearly. We have admired Ukrainians and Zelensky for defending the values which we adhere to and which until very recently the Americans championed. Now it seems to me it's much less clear that that's the case.
The ambassadors said Sir Keir was right to try to shore up ties with Washington, but added the uncertainties meant the UK needed to look elsewhere too, to Europe, Canada and Australia.
A British man captured while fighting alongside Ukrainian troops in Russia's Kursk region has been sentenced to 19 years in prison. The Foreign Office has strongly condemned the sentence, saying James Anderson should be treated as a prisoner of war. The 22-year-old, who's a former member of the British Army, was convicted of terrorism and mercenary activities in a trial held behind closed doors. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
James Scott Rees Anderson from Banbury in Oxfordshire was captured in November last year, months after Ukrainian forces launched a surprise incursion into Russia's Kursk region. The regional judiciary says he admitted his guilt and repented. It added that Mr. Anderson would serve the first 5 years in what is formally known as prison in Russia and the remainder in slightly less harsh conditions in a high-security penal colony. Mr. Anderson is the first British citizen to be captured and convicted by Russia for fighting with the Ukrainians. In 2022, two captured British men, Aidan Aslin and Sean Pinner, were sentenced to death by a Russian proxy court in the occupied Ukrainian city of Donetsk. They were subsequently released as part of a prisoner exchange.
Police say they fear that a Chinese PhD student who's been convicted of drugging and raping 10 women in London and China could potentially be one of the most prolific sexual predators the UK has ever seen. 28-year-old Jin Kaozhou secretly filmed the attacks and kept the videos as souvenirs. Officers say the material they uncovered suggests Zhou could have raped up to 50 other people. Our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford was at the Inner London Crown Court.
When Jin Kaozhou was arrested for rape in January last year, one of the key questions detectives had for him was how many more women had he attacked.
How many victims are there?
No comments.
How long is this going on for?
No comments.
Zhou would meet women on dating apps, lure them back to his apartment, give them alcoholic drinks spiked with drugs like GHB, then rape them while they were unconscious or drifting in and out of consciousness. Seven of his victims were in China and detectives have never been able to identify them. The other three were in London and two gave evidence at his trial. They described waking up to find him having sex with them. Commander Kevin Southworth of the Metropolitan Police says this is one of the worst cases of its kind.
We certainly have video evidence of as many as potentially 50 further victim survivors who were desperate to trace so that we can actually establish what has happened to them. This man may well turn out to be one of the most prolific sexual predators that we've ever seen in this country, and it's vital that we bring him to justice for all of his offending.
At his flat, detectives found date rape drugs, alcohol and hidden cameras on which Zhou recorded his rapes. The videos which were shown to the jury proved to be key in securing a conviction. Detectives are appealing for any women who've spent time alone with Zhou to get in touch, however little they remember of the encounter. Judge Rosina Cottage will sentence him at Inner London Crown Court in June. She warned today that he'll go to prison for a very long time.
The US government has confirmed that it has been holding talks with Hamas over releasing American hostages being held in Gaza. Washington has until now avoided direct engagement with the group, which it considers a terrorist organisation. The White House said Israel had been consulted prior to the talks. More from our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
A senior Hamas official has told the BBC that two direct meetings have been held with an American official. Asked about the contacts, the White House spokeswoman, Caroline Levitt, said President Trump's special envoy for hostages, Adam Bola, had the authority to conduct negotiations. It was, she said, a good faith effort to do what's right for the American people. Israel's only official reaction so far has been a terse statement from the office of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel, it said, had expressed to the United States its position regarding direct talks with Hamas. It's not clear how much Israeli officials were told about the negotiations. Given Washington's 30-year ban on contacts with Hamas, these talks are highly unusual, but not completely unprecedented. The BBC understands that a single meeting was held with a member of the Biden administration in April last year, also to discuss American hostages.
The foreign ministers of the UK, France and Germany have urged Israel to allow the resumption of humanitarian aid to Gaza. In a joint statement, they described the situation there as catastrophic and expressed deep concern at Israel's decision to halt the entry of goods and supplies to the Strip. Israel has been asked to comment. Nick Eardley from BBC Verify has more.
Getting more aid into Gaza was a key component of the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. But on Sunday, Israel said it was stopping aid crossings, calling on Hamas to agree to extend the first phase of the ceasefire. Aid agencies are now warning the blocking of relief is having a significant impact. The World Food Programme told the BBC it had enough stock to provide assistance to Gazans for less than 2 weeks. It warned if crossings into Gaza remain closed, it may have to further reduce rations. Christian Aid, which operates in the Strip, said market prices had increased by as much as a quarter, with some goods like meat, fish and imported vegetables starting to disappear altogether. Christian Aid also said the lack of relief risked what they called an even greater humanitarian catastrophe if aid deliveries don't resume soon.
The government has defended its plans to make major cuts to welfare spending in the Chancellor's upcoming spring statement, saying there is a moral case for doing so. The Treasury today sent its proposals to the official forecaster. It's thought a grim economic outlook will force Rachel Reeves to find savings to meet her own fiscal rules, as our business reporter Ben King explains.
Last year, Rachel Reeves set herself a target to have the national debt falling by the end of this parliament, which she was on track to hit by a narrow margin of less than £10 billion. That margin has disappeared. The Treasury says this is due to a mix of factors, including the global rise in government borrowing costs and technical changes in the forecasting process. The Chancellor is expected to bridge the gap by cutting spending, including on benefits. The cost of welfare is on course to rise dramatically this Parliament, with health and disability benefit spending forecast to hit £100 billion a year by 2030. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, told Today on Radio 4 it was right to try to slow the rise.
This has got to be a clear focus for our government. There's a moral case here for making sure that people who can work are able to work. There's a practical point here as well, because our current situation is unsustainable. So on both of those measures, I think the welfare secretary is looking at the right area of policy.
Some Labour MPs will resist welfare cuts, but the Shadow Chancellor, Mel Stride, said they should have been done sooner.
The great tragedy, though, will be if that money is simply going to be used to plug a black hole that they have created because they've mismanaged the economy, rather than reducing or reversing some of the tax decisions that they've taken, which are about to come into effect and will be very painfully felt by people and businesses up and down the country.
Donald Trump's policies will put further pressure on the public finances. Widespread tariffs could hurt the British economy, even if they aren't applied to UK exports. The government also wants to increase defence spending because of the uncertainty created by Donald Trump. The Chancellor faces some painful choices.
A child has died and another has been injured after they were hit by a car on a sports pitch in Cumbria. The driver of a black BMW has been arrested. The immediate family members of the two children have been informed. Alison Freeman reports.
Cumbria police said they were called to Kendall Rugby Club just before 5 o'clock this evening after receiving reports that a car hit two children on the pitch. The force confirmed that one of the children has died and a second has been treated by paramedics. Specialist investigators are at the scene, which has been cordoned off. The driver of the car, a man in his 40s, has been arrested on suspicion of causing death by dangerous driving. Officers say they're treating it as an isolated incident and that there's no suggestion it was terror-related. The rugby club say they are deeply saddened by what has happened and that they are fully cooperating with the authorities. The club's facilities will remain closed while the investigation is carried out.
Aspirin could become a cancer treatment, according to new research revealing the drug's ability to prevent some cancers from spreading. Scientists describe the unexpected findings as a eureka moment, but experts caution against cancer patients taking the painkiller without speaking to their doctor first. More from our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
There have been hints that aspirin can stop some cancers from spreading for more than a decade. Finally, scientists think they understand how. It's in that moment when cells break off the main tumour and try to spread around the body like seeds in the wind. Part of our immune defences, called T cells, can seek out and destroy these lone cancerous cells as they try to take root. But the research on animals showed that another part of our blood was suppressing the T cells and making it harder for them to fight the cancer. Aspirin helps prevent that from happening, unleashing the immune system. Professor Rahul Roy Chowdhury performed the research at the University of Cambridge.
Why this is important is that by better understanding how aspirin works, we might better be able to understand who might benefit from taking aspirin to prevent cancer spread, and we might be able to develop better drugs to prevent cancer from spreading.
The big question, though, is if you have cancer, should you be taking aspirin today? The answer remains no, because it can cause dangerous side effects, including strokes, and decisions like this should be made alongside a doctor. Big clinical trials are expected to report soon, and they will reveal whether aspirin should become part of cancer treatment.
The social media influencer Andrew Tate has said he will return from Florida to Romania in a few days, where he and his brother Tristan are facing charges of rape and human trafficking. The pair arrived in the US last week after a travel ban imposed by the Romanian authorities was lifted. Florida's Attorney General has since launched a criminal investigation against them. The brothers deny all allegations against them. Here's our North America correspondent, Neda Taufik.
When Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan suddenly flew to the United States last week after a travel ban was lifted by Romanian prosecutors, it seemed they were perhaps ready to make Florida their new home. The self-described misogynist had said that he was going to move back to America after Donald Trump's 2024 election victory. But in a new social media post, he called his time in Miami a two-week holiday and said he would be going back to Romania in a few days. In a podcast interview earlier this week, he also said he would fly back to Romania and obey his bail conditions. Some of his accusers have expressed concern that he might not. Nevertheless, the Tate brothers face new legal trouble in the United States. Florida's attorney general says he's directed prosecutors to execute search warrants and issue subpoenas as part of a criminal investigation into Andrew and Tristan Tate. Andrew Tate has claimed officials in Florida are trying to fabricate charges against an innocent man.
The Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood is calling for new guidance for judges in England and Wales to be reversed over concerns of creating two-tier sentencing. Her opposite number, the Conservatives' Robert Jenrick, argued that the guidance would make custodial sentences for offenders from ethnic minority backgrounds less likely and undermine the principle of equality before the law. More from our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The Independent Sentencing Council has issued new guidance to the judiciary, which will come into effect next month. The council has said that pre-sentencing reports, which give judges more details on a defendant's background before deciding on a custodial or a community sentence, would usually be necessary for a range of offenders, including women, young adults, those with physical disabilities or poor mental health, or who come from an ethnic, cultural or faith minority. Robert Jenrick claimed the guidance was biased against straight white males and suggested that offenders who had pre-sentencing reports were less likely to be jailed. The Sentencing Council said people from some backgrounds faced disadvantages in the criminal justice system. Labour strategists regard accusations of two-tier justice as politically toxic. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, told the Commons she was against differential treatment. She then announced on social media that she'd be writing to the Sentencing Council to express her displeasure and to call for the guidance to be reversed.
The government has announced plans to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of fighting in Europe during the Second World War with 4 days of celebrations across the country this spring. The anniversary is likely to be the last major commemoration to involve a significant number of veterans. Events will include street parties and the return of thousands of ceramic poppies to the Tower of London. A service at Westminster Abbey and a concert on Horse Guards Parade will conclude events on VE Day on May the 8th. Wall Street stock markets have rallied after the US Commerce Secretary suggested a compromise could soon be reached on the import tariffs President Trump has imposed on Canada and Mexico. The market gains made since Mr. Trump's election were mostly reversed when the 25% levies came into force yesterday. Our North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury reports.
Less than 24 hours after imposing new tariffs on Canada and Mexico, the US Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said Donald Trump may offer some relief. Speaking to Bloomberg, he suggested the administration was aiming for a middle ground, with a decision expected later today. The auto industry could be a key exemption after warnings that tariffs could cut a third of North American vehicle production by next week. President Trump has reportedly spoken to the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today, and Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum will talk to him tomorrow. However, few expect the trade war to be short-lived, with even harsher tariffs planned next month.
Time now for a first look at the papers, and many lead on the fallout of President Trump's decision to stop sharing US intelligence with Ukraine. The Guardian calls the measure a serious blow for Kyiv. A Ukrainian MP tells The Times she cannot imagine how many people will pay the ultimate price for the decision. The front page of The Eye focuses on the Treasury proposals to slash welfare spending. The paper says it's seen documents that reveal the Chancellor has cut up to £1.4 billion in spending for schools and hospital modernisation to help fund her multi-billion pound pay deals with trade unions. A picture of Prince William looking thoughtful during a royal visit to a hospital in Reading appears on the front of the Daily Mirror. The paper says the prince used the event to honour the sacrifices made by the NHS staff during the pandemic. Emma Raducanu has spoken about the distress she suffered after being stalked at the Dubai Open Tennis last month. The player is now receiving extra security in California after a man who had followed her across four previous tournaments showed up at the match. Our sports news correspondent Katie Gornall reports.
Emma Raducanu nearly didn't make the trip to California for the Indian Wells Open. Just 2 weeks ago, she was targeted by a stalker at the Dubai Championships. Speaking to reporters for the first time about her ordeal, Raducanu said that she couldn't see the ball through her tears and could barely breathe when she spotted the man watching her match with Karolina Muchova. It later emerged that she'd been approached twice by the man off court and he'd exhibited fixated behaviour towards her. Raducanu said the ordeal put her safety under the spotlight.
Well, I think that since that incident, I've definitely got like increased attention, great security, more so. And I think that's all we can do is kind of look at what happened and react to it in a better way, in a more positive way, rather than looking back and kind of blaming the situation.
It's not the first time the former US Open champion has experienced stalking. In 2022, a different man was given a 5-year restraining order after he walked 23 miles to her London home. She was 19 at the time. And she's far from alone. The British number one Katie Bolter is among a number of other players who've dealt with similar experiences, underlining the security issues that many female athletes face.
The football associations of England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales say they intend to submit a joint bid to host the 2035 Women's World Cup. It's after the world governing body FIFA announced that the tournament will be hosted in Europe or Africa. Bids for the 2031 and 2035 editions must be submitted later this year. Golfers are often romantic about the sport's ancient links to St Andrews, but until today, Dalmuir, near Glasgow, had gone largely unnoticed. The council-run course is facing closure as part of spending cuts by the local authority. This evening, the local authority approved its budget for the coming year, which doesn't include money for the course. Enter Bryson DeChambeau, one of the sport's biggest names, who's teeing up the fight to save it. Our Scotland correspondent David Wallace Lockhart has the story.
The US Open champion Bryson DeChambeau spends his time on the most famous golf courses in the world, so you wouldn't expect the council-run Dalmuir course near Glasgow to be 18 holes that were on his radar. But with its future under threat as West Dumbartonshire Council tries to balance its books, he made an unexpected, passionate plea to keep it open.
I think it's important for people to understand that if you don't have golf courses like Dalmuir, and a community like Dalmuir, it's difficult to continue to grow. Not only just a sport, but just a community.
So why is one of the world's top golfers getting involved? This video was posted on social media by a prominent tour caddy, Craig Conley, who lives near Dalmuir and is campaigning to keep the course open. He roped in one of sport's biggest names to help the cause. This is not an isolated incident. Despite Scotland being the birthplace of the sport, a number of public golf courses, which are considerably cheaper to play than private ones, have been threatened with closure in recent years. In December, councillors in Dundee voted to close the city's only municipal course. Dalmuir's golfers will be hoping that Bryson DeChambeau's intervention helps them avoid a similar fate.
The headlines again. President Volodymyr Zelensky says there's been positive movement in his talks with the US, despite Washington confirming that intelligence sharing with Kyiv had been suspended. In a televised address, President Macron has said that Europe must be prepared for the possibility that the United States would not remain on its side. Police fear a Chinese student who's been convicted of drugging and raping 10 women could be one of the most prolific sexual predators the UK has ever seen, with dozens more victims. Research suggests the painkiller aspirin could prevent some cancers from spreading in what scientists have described as a eureka moment. BBC News.
With Chris Aldridge. And now with a look at that all-important weather forecast. Good morning, Louise Lear.
Hello there. After a bitterly cold start on Wednesday morning, temperatures recovered. It was a mild spring day for many, but they peaked at just shy of 17 degrees in Sandton Downham, Suffolk. And we could see similar story as we go through the day today, but there is a freshening wind and that's preventing temperatures from falling low enough for a touch of frost. So, hopefully frost-free across England and Wales. There will be a little bit of patchy fog, not amounting to too much. That will lift away. So, some lovely sunshine to start the day, perhaps some thicker cloud developing across Wales and southwest England as we go into the afternoon, and we could see a few scattered showers by the end of the day. Temperatures, though, still likely to peak between 13 and 16 degrees. Now, across Scotland and Northern Ireland, heavy rain continues to push its way steadily northwards. It will be sitting across the northern and western Isles for much of the day, accompanied by a strong southerly wind, gusts to the northwest in excess of 40 to 45 miles an hour. For eastern Scotland, though, it'll be a bright and sunny start, and gradually as we go through the day, Scotland and Northern Ireland will dry up, brighten up, a veil of high cloud, but not a bad afternoon. Highs generally between 10 and 13 degrees. Now, as we move out of Thursday into Friday, a warm front will start to push in from the west, and it's going to impact England and Wales. It will bring some erratic outbursts of showery rain from west to east through the day on Friday. So some places will escape the worst of it and there will be some bright spells still. Not a bad day though for Scotland and Northern Ireland. Lighter winds in comparison to of late and top temperatures generally across the country ranging from 13 to 16 degrees. Now, as we move out of Friday into the start of the weekend, there'll be a good deal of fine, dry, sunny weather around for many. And again, it will feel pleasantly warm in the spring sunshine. Make the most of it because the weather story is on the change to somewhat fresher and slightly more unsettled weather into the week ahead. Enjoy.
Thank you, Louise. Louise Lear with the late weather bulletin. And now, Radio 4, it's time to hear Juliet Stevenson, Indira Varma, Chipo Chung and Sharla Nix read from My Dear Kabul, a shared diary kept by a group of writers, which begins after Afghanistan fell to the Taliban in August 2021. In tonight's episode, autumn arrives and the diarists consider their futures.
My Dear Kabul, by writers in the Paranda Group. Episode 3. Exile. Following the Taliban's return to power, a group of women writers continue to keep a collective diary on WhatsApp. By the autumn, many of the writers need official documents, especially those who hope to leave the country. For some of the writers, born in times when records